Thank you very much, and like we thank Michael for inviting me. We had a very nice dinner last night, and which made me realize that even though the theme is speciation this week, but I'm thinking that what I'm going to talk about is maybe pretty marginal to the whole program. In particular, the type of modeling I'm going to talk about is not the type of computational biology that a lot of people in this participating in this program are involved in. But maybe it's good for you to have a little diversion. So I want to start off with a question that I'd like to pose to the audience. Does anyone know the answer to that question? Notwithstanding that I'm not saying what a species is, because I don't know. But anyway, because there are about, 28 definitions of species, it's kind of hard to say what that number is, but rough estimate is 10 to 100 million different categories of life forms exist extant today, and you can do a very rough estimate that what we see today is about 1% of all the forms that existed over the history of life on Earth. So the point is that there is a lot of diversity right now, and I think there was a science article that one of the points they made, if you pick up a handful of dirt, you have more individual organisms, that's not species, but more individual microorganisms in your hand than there are stars in the universe. So you can imagine that, for example, among microorganisms, the diversity is just staggering. And one of the Craig Venter, the guy who did half of the Human Genome Project, is now, I don't know whether it was with the money he made there, but he's now cruising the oceans in the ship, and he just takes buckets full of water and analyzes the genetic diversity that he finds in there. And, it seems sometimes that most of the diversity that exists has not been discovered yet. But it's very diverse, and there is one very fascinating fact about all this, and that is it all comes from one thing, so to speak, which is probably not quite true that it is one thing, but it just logically it all goes back to some very small, comparatively very small gene pool. And that's just because what you see today has some ancestors, and if you go back far enough, there's only one ancestor of whatever you see today. There's this notion of, I think it's called LUCA, the last universal common ancestor, which is supposed to be some universal some gene pool that is ancestral to everything that we see today. So then, of course, the question arises, how does diversification occur? So you see a lot. The beginning there was very little, so how does that, that's kind of the problem. And so diversification is usually called speciation in evolutionary biology. Well, and it must have been rampant, and I'm not going to talk about these 28 species concepts. Instead, so everyone can have their own notion about what a species is. Just think of, different Darwin's finches or something like that, where it's often quite obvious, with birds, it's just in terms of what they look like, but of course with bacteria, you can't really look at them, so maybe it's something else, but I don't want to talk about what it is. But actually with bacteria, I'm going to give you an example of what we think might be at least incipient species later on. But so surprisingly, or at least to me, I came in, I'm not a biologist by training actually, and I kind of came in from the side into this field of evolutionary biology, and if I, so I can, it's, easy for me to kind of take a step back. And to me, it's a little surprising that such a central process, such as diversification, which is a central process to the history of life, is in some sense, in the traditional view, outside the realm of Darwinism. And that's not, of course, a lot of people would say that's not correct, but what I mean by that is that the predominant explanation for the mechanisms leading to diversification is what is called allopatric speciation, which is simply the notion that you have some ancestral population, and by some, I'll call it magical process, it gets split into two, say, halves. They don't need to be halves, but two portions, each one of which occupies a different spatial region. So they're still the same species, but they get separated geographically. And then, so the story goes, selection pressures, climate, for example, or predators or whatever, is different in these two spatial regions, and therefore these initially identical subpopulations embark onto different evolutionary trajectories, so to speak, because they experience different selection pressures, and if you wait long enough, then they're going to be different species. So when I said surprisingly, it's kind of outside the realm of Darwinism, of course that process of different evolution trajectories is not outside the realm, but the process of the initial splitting requires some kind of geographical thing, or maybe a geological, a river cutting through some mountains or something, or some mountains coming up. So the original split is not an evolutionary process. So, there's some, it's actually, which is surprisingly, well, it's, let's say it's a, it's an intuitively plausible or appealing mechanism. I don't think it has actually been demonstrated in very many cases. So here's an example which I, being from Canada, like to present. This is the famous, well, in Canada, famous Canadian goose. And here's a close relative, which is the Hawaiian goose. And supposedly that's a case of allopatric speciation. Somehow, these guys, I don't know how it happened, but somehow, things can travel very long distances, that's for sure. In various ways, but somehow these guys got to these islands, and of course from then on they were isolated from these guys, because it's a long distance. And so now they look, in some sense they look very similar, but in some other sense, if you look more closely, they look pretty different. So this is classified as a different species. Of course, it's not quite known what happens when you bring them back together. For example, whether they breed. At least I don't know that. But this is cited in the literature as one example of allopatric speciation. The contrary, or an alternative process would be sympatric speciation, in which you simply don't require the geographical isolation for diversification. And this has been classically deemed to be an unlikely process because it's not clear, it's just theoretically much less, or intuitively much less appealing, how things that are, so you would now have one population that is at some location and it would somehow split up without this geographical isolation. And it's just not quite clear how this would happen. And in fact, so I call this, the classical view, and this has not, it's not just a straw man. I mean, there's people have explicitly said that, adaptation or evolutionary theory explains directional selection, but it cannot explain, this is a quote from a popular science book by Levinson and Lewin, that cannot explain the splitting of species. And so, well, I would say, what I'm going to talk about today is kind of refuting this statement. But there is a lot of, I'm just kind of turning into an empirical biologist, but I'm not really an empirical biologist. So I can't really say that with any authority, but my impression is that there are as many cases that are very hard to explain with allopatric speciation scenarios as are cases that are easy to explain with allopatric or are known to be allopatric speciation scenarios. Here's one case. This is the cichlid radiation in the Great African Lakes. These lakes are very big. So there's still a lot of spatial area, and of course you can always try and make some arguments that, you know, when you see diversification in such a big spatial arena, that there is some kind of local micro-allopatric things going on. But nevertheless, compared to, say, you know, continental processes, these are small areas. And in the case of, I think in the case of Lake Victoria, which is neither one of those, because I couldn't find any pictures, I think these lakes are older. But in Lake Victoria, you see a similar radiation, and this is the work of, among others, Dieter Tautz, who showed that in Lake Victoria, essentially the cichlids are monophyletic. In other words, they came from one ancestor, and it is also believed that Lake Victoria was actually not there about 500,000 years ago. So, in other words, this, you know, hundreds or thousands of species arose from a single ancestor in a few hundred thousand years. And that is very hard to explain with allopatric speciation, without anything actually driving the split. And there are other examples, mostly with fish, but also with some insects. And if you believe what I'm going to say, there are some examples with... Well, actually, I should say there definitely are some examples with microorganisms, with bacteria. So what I'm going to do in the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to first talk about... You know, I mentioned one of the reasons why people don't believe this is an important process is because it's maybe intuitively less appealing. I'm going to try and convince you that it's actually theoretically a very plausible process, this sympatric speciation, or as we call it, adaptive speciation. We call it adaptive speciation because the splitting is an adaptation. The splitting itself is a response to selection pressures. It's not a consequence of, in these processes, it's not a consequence of geographical isolation. And in the second part, I'm going to show you some experiments we did trying to, you know, show that this actually happens in real organisms. Okay, so here is the picture of what you need for sympatric or adaptive speciation. You need a population. Let's say this is your description of your population. Okay, so yeah, I mean, this is of course extremely schematic, and no population is like that. It's only one trait that we're looking at. Think of Darwin's finches, beak size. So this would be your ancestor. If you measure, you know, let's say you characterize a population by the distribution of beak sizes. So you have a lot, you know, most birds have intermediate beak sizes. Some of them have small ones. Some of them have large ones. Now, what needs to happen for adaptive speciation is that these guys must sit somehow for some reason on a fitness minimum, so that actually these guys in the middle are doing worse than the guys at the margins. And then, you know, what is supposed to happen is that this population splits into two different ones, such that you now have two modes in this distribution, and these guys don't mate with each other. Then you have two different species. One species with a smaller beak and one with a bigger beak. There are two... Oops. Yeah, this thing is... There are two basic problems with this that you have to solve in order to make this a plausible process. One is ecological, one is genetic, roughly speaking. The ecological one is, why would you ever sit on a fitness minimum? Because if you don't initially sit there, you just move up one, you just go there. You wouldn't reach the other side of the fitness minimum. So this seems like a knife edge situation. You somehow need to make sure that you sit exactly on the fitness minimum so that you would have the selection pressures favoring all the marginal phenotypes and not just the marginal phenotypes on one side. So that's one problem. The other problem is, even if you do sit on a fitness minimum, if you don't have assortative mating mechanisms, then random mating always recreates these intermediate types, which would look something like this. So you can't actually split up. Because, yes? Sorry?
This random mating.
Yeah. Random mating.
Yeah, or is it just like that it makes the population generally more
practical? Well, that's a good question, you know. I mean, I'm going to touch on this just briefly, on this random mating thing, how it's solved, and it's one of the big issues that mainly population geneticists raise when these models are presented. Because you need assortative mating, and then you need to answer, you know, questions about the evolution of assortative mating. But as a matter of fact, I don't think there is any population in the world that mates randomly. Because if you think about, you know, I don't know, I don't want to make any bad jokes, but if you think about frogs and stones, I mean, somehow a frog has to know that a stone is not a frog. So they have to have some mechanism of recognizing other frogs. And so I think immediately that means they would, you know, they discriminate in some way. And maybe there is some region where they don't discriminate, you know, very, very much. And then, they need to be discriminating in some sense. And so, you know, in some ways, I don't think there is any population that mates randomly. Humans, for example, of course, is not the case that they mate randomly. And, sorry? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, that's a good point. Of course, what is meant here is mate randomly with respect to that character that is under disruptive selection. But even that, I mean, in Darwin's finches, for example, where, you know, it's either beak size or body size, I would say it's unlikely that they have mate randomly, that they don't discriminate. Nevertheless, I mean, this is kind of the null assumption, you know, the most conservative assumption. And it is true that random mating, you know, I mean, even if it's not random, there's probably some, you know, degree of assortment. And if the degree of assortment is not very strong with respect to that character, then what you would expect is that you can't diverge even if you're under disruptive selection, because if there are enough matings between extremal types, they always recreate these intermediate types. So, but it is true that, of course, random mating is, as an assumption, I would say, comes, you know, from the traditional population genetic modeling, where, of course, this makes everything a lot easier. So if you have, you know, these, you know, Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, these very simple population genetic models, of course, you assume random mating at the beginning. So, the theory I'm going to talk about is mainly concerned with the ecological aspect here. In traditional sympatric speciation models, well, they suffer from this fact that they somehow have to assume that you sit on this fitness minimum, and then they study the evolution of assortative mating. So it seems like this assumption that you sit on the fitness minimum is very special somehow, and what I'm going to argue is that it is not special. So I want to walk you through a very simple example. Let's, you know, stick with this beak size in birds, and let's assume we have two ecological ingredients. One is food abundance. So let's assume, these birds eat seeds, and for each beak size, there is an optimal seed size. So if you have intermediate beak size, you want to eat your best at eating intermediate seed sizes. And so this is essentially the distribution of these seed sizes. So there's a lot of seeds of intermediate size, and fewer seeds of small and large size. So that's one ecological ingredient. The other ecological ingredient is the strength of competition that individuals exert on each other. If I have a certain beak size and I want to know how much another individual affects me, then it's likely that if that other individual has a similar beak size, it affects me more than if it has a dissimilar beak size, simply because it eats the same type of food. So if that other individual, if I have a large beak and the other guy has a small beak, I don't care, because he eats small seeds, which I don't even want. The other guy also has a large beak, so I mean, this is kind of the caricature. If the other guy also has a large beak, then that bothers me because he's going to eat my food. This is actually, this is an old artwork from my daughter, just goes to show that I've given this talk a few times, or at least I've used this picture a few times. But anyway, she somehow understood what I was. I tried to explain this to her. You know, beaks and birds and seeds. So this is kind of the situation. So these guys compete very little with each other. This guy eats small seeds, even though he has quite a big beak. But this guy eats big seeds, and among them they compete a lot. Among them they compete a lot, but between them they don't compete a lot. So now we can just formulate a stochastic process with this. In this stochastic process, you have a bunch of individuals. Each individual is given by its beak size or its body size, so that's just a continuously varying number. At each step of this stochastic process, you calculate, so each individual has a birth rate, which is the same for all individuals. And each individual is assigned a death rate, and the ecological ingredients go into that death rate. The death rate is low if you have a phenotype with a lot of seeds, where the resource abundance is high. So the death rate is low if you have a trait value around here, and it's higher if you have a marginal trait value. And your death rate is low if you are rare, if you don't have a lot of similar individuals in the population. So if you are in the middle here, you have a low death rate, but if a lot of other people are also in the middle, that increases your death rate. And these stochastic processes, or the stochastic models, they just work with these rates. So at each point in time, you choose, based on these rates, you choose which event happens, birth or death. If a death occurs, you choose which individual dies according to these individual death rates. So individuals with high death rates are more likely to die. When they die, they're just removed from the population. If a birth occurs, you just choose one individual at random because they all have the same birth rate. And then you produce an offspring from that chosen individual which has the same phenotype as the parent, subject to some small variation which is supposed to model the mutation process. So with a small probability, that offspring has a different trait value than the parent chosen from some mutational distribution. And so here there is, in this initial model, there is no sexual reproduction. So every parents just breed through, except for some mutations. Yes? Yeah.
So in other words, when you draw a resource button, you draw a set of raw buttons.
That's right. Yeah. So
I assume that the kind of toy mechanism where you combine those two tech, people might be better to be adequate. In other words, you should be better to simulate the actual resource button, even the number of competitors.
Yeah. So that's a very good point. And you can do that. It's just a more complicated model, and we actually did that. So then you just have also a dynamic for the resources. Then you need to assume that each individual has some sort of utilization curve. And based on all the individuals and on the utilization curves present, you can then calculate the resource abundance. And then you get, so to speak, an emergent red curve from this dynamics of the resource. And so then essentially what happens is then the parameter, instead of what we will see in this model, and which is, you know, maybe clear to from the outset, is that the width of this curve, it was going to play an important role. If you do it the way you suggested, then the width of these individual utilization curves are going to play that role. So if the, you know, whether you are more of a generalist or more of a specialist. But essentially, I mean, this is the model you're suggesting is a more flexible model. For example, you could then model the evolution of this niche width and so on. But essentially, it's going to be, at least in the scenarios that we are interested in, it's going to come back to this model. It's going to have the same dynamics.
But in the same way, the phenotype that we understand, I mean, I understand the theory that the second part, the common phenotypes have higher death rate than rare phenotype. As you said, the spirit is that they are competing for resources, but then the question is how did they emerge as common phenotypes? Maybe your model would explain that, but basically it turns out, at least with the first one, that it's disadvantageous to be a common phenotype because it's a higher.
Okay, well, let's see what the dynamics of this model are. Let's say we start off with some population that is over, that sits over here. So let's say your initial population, they're all. You know, start out with, you initialize the model with 500 individuals, and they're all, you choose from a distribution that has phenotypes around here. So what happens? Well, here's what happens. The population evolves to this place where you have most resources. Mathematically, the reason is that this effect is second order, this effect is first order, as long as the derivative is non-zero. So that's the reason why in the initial phase, you, whether you start from here or from here, from any place in this very simple model, from any starting place, you evolve to the middle first, to this place where, so everybody starts to be at the place where they are the most, where the resources are most abundant. And then the question is, what happens next? So I don't know whether that explains your question.
Partly, but I think that would depend very much on the actual parameters in the evolutionary process, because you can imagine that the second factor will play a greater role. So they die out much faster when they come, become common. And then, and I'm not convinced that this behavior is universal. Kind of. My understanding is that you have to show some kind of a phase diagram for the model that, and in one area of phase diagram you will see this indicator. In other areas of phase diagram you may not see that. So my question is about the new phase.
So, I mean, I can tell you that as long as you have this setup here, this is this always happens. For the reason I just mentioned, as long as you're not in the middle, this is first order.
What do you mean by this setup? Because kind of the second assumption is that by frequency depends, common phenotypes have higher death rate than rare phenotypes. How mathematically is that? It could be kind of a very steep function of death rate versus
analogy
or smooth function. And my point is that depending on how your model is dependent, you may have different behavior.
Yeah.
But I assume that it's an extremely sharp, the death rate is an extremely sharp function of this commonality or whatever.
So that this is...
If you approach the woman, it dies immediately. Or as soon as it becomes kind of...
The thing is, as long as you are away from the optimum, from this place here, it's always true that the ones on this side, I mean, even if you're common here, the marginal ones on this side do better, while the marginal ones on this side do worse.
But they are penalized by the second part.
Not the marginal ones. Not the, you know, if you have a population distribution like this here, then the marginal ones on this side are always, they just do better. It's not infinite, yeah. I mean, okay, so if the death rates overall are too high, then of course that's stochastic. I mean, this is a stochastic process, okay? This is a with finite population, so this is always going extinct. In the very long run, so that's the only absorbing state. And of course, if you have extremely small population sizes because death rates are so high, or because resources are, you know, because you choose the parameters in whatever way you want to choose them, then the population goes extinct before you see the evolutionary process unfold. Because it's finite. I mean, this is, you know, because you have density dependence in here, even if you have a very high... So this is... Yeah, I'm just saying that zero is the only absorbing state, and of course, I'm just saying that if you have very high death rates, of course, then that absorbing state is reached maybe... You know, I mean, if maybe it's reached once you're here, and then of course nothing happens. But what I'm saying is that as long as you have a smooth function with a zero derivative here, and the same over here, then you will always see this initial convergence. And as long as the population survives, then you will always see this initial convergence to this optimal state. And so. But what happens next depends very much on the relative widths of those two functions. And it's actually quite intuitively easy to see why. Let's say everybody is exactly at this point. Now you have a mutant that is different. It has a disadvantage because it has fewer resources, but it also has an advantage because it experiences less competition because of this, you know, because of the red and the green curve. And it's just a question of which one's bigger, whether the advantage is bigger than the disadvantage or vice versa. That determines what happens next. So if the advantage is smaller than the disadvantage, so if this curve, I mean, roughly speaking, if this curve declines faster than this curve, then if you are different from this optimal phenotype with respect to the green curve, if you are over here, let's say, so everybody is here, and you look at the mutant that is here. If this curve declines very fast, it has a very big disadvantage. And if this curve doesn't decline very fast, its advantage is not very big. And that means, mathematically speaking, and I'll show you in a moment why that's exactly the threshold, if this inequality is true, then you will just stay in the middle. Mutants cannot invade. So in other words, in that case, the process is simply, from any starting point, you converge to the middle and that's it. And as you see, that this is it's just an equality, and as you can, you know, maybe guess, if the equality is reversed, the opposite happens. If the equality is reversed, then as you sit here, mutants that are different from this phenotype that's optimal, but only with respect, optimality, of course, has to be understood in some very loose sense, because it turns out it's not optimal, it's actually a fitness minimum. Optimal with respect to this green curve. So if everybody's sitting here, if this inequality, if the inequality is reversed, then the advantage of being different is outweighs the disadvantage of having fewer resources. And then what you see is evolutionary branching in this asexual model. So here you essentially have, of course, very extreme assortative mating, because you just breed through. So the mating is not a problem if you have asexual reproduction. And then you see this evolutionary branching. So in this stochastic process, you just see the splitting. And the point here, so this is a very paradigmatic feature of this model, in the sense that you can see this in all kinds of different models, not just in this one. The paradigmatic feature is that populations evolve, it sounds a little paradoxical, but it's actually not. Populations evolve to sit on fitness minima. And the reason is simply that if you have frequency dependence, which comes in through this red curve, which means that your fitness depends on the population composition, if that is the case, then as the population evolves, the fitness landscape changes. So you don't have a static fitness landscape, and that's shown here. This is the fitness landscape. This is the green curve. That doesn't change, but the green curve is not the fitness. The fitness is a combination of the green and the red curve, depending on where the population is sitting. This is the fitness profile. As long as you are away from the optimum, you sit on one side of this fitness profile, of this minimum. That's why you evolve up this side. But as you move, as the population moves to the middle, this fitness minimum catches up with the population, because the fitness landscape changes as the population changes. And once they reach the middle, you sit exactly on the fitness minimum. So the whole process is dynamic, and that's why you evolve to sit on a fitness minimum. And then when you sit on a fitness, so this is actually an attractor in this one-dimensional phenotype space. The fitness minimum, of course, it's not there before you are there, before you sit in the middle. I mean, it's there, but you are before. So you're always moving up the gradient here. So it's always adaptive, you know, classical gradient dynamics, but in such a way that, as I said, that the fitness minimum catches up with the population, and then at the end point, you sit on the fitness minimum, and then you branch. So I mean, that's essentially in terms of the theory. The main point I want to make, that this situation where you sit on a fitness minimum is not generally a knife-edge result. It's not a non-generic assumption once you allow for frequency-dependent interactions.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so that's another very good point. And that's why I was actually, or part of the reason why I said in the beginning, this type of modeling is probably not quite what a lot of people are used to, because it's, I would call this, you know, conceptual modeling. So I don't think, I mean, there are actually a couple of papers that try to measure these utilization widths of, and you know, within, that are, let's just say, that are trying to measure parameters that are related to those ones. But the problem, for example, the sigma alpha curve, I mean, that's a very difficult thing to measure, because you would have to compete different phenotypes and see how, somehow measure this competitive effect. So, I mean, I don't think this is a model that is really suitable to be applied to any specific population. What it is suitable for is to show that for half the parameter space you get this phenomenon, essentially. Few hundred, you know, it depends a little bit on where you start, and then once you, I mean, it's, well, so I'm just going to, you saw these formulas, I'm just going to explain the, so to speak, the deterministic skeleton of this model, and it is a deterministic process, so it's, but, so I mean, you can see here a little bit, you know, these are, it's time, 10 to times 10 to the 4, so these are in 10,000s of generations. So once, you know, depending on where you start, and then of course it depends on mutation rate and mutation distributions and so on, how fast you get to this place, and then, you know, maybe it takes a few hundred generations until they actually start splitting and diverging. So it happens fast compared to, say, allopatric scenarios where you would have to wait, you know, a few hundred thousand generations. So this is, because it is an adaptive process, it happens fast. Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and that's a question that's been studied in the last 2 or 3 years a lot. Like, essentially, and I'm going to say just a few words about genetic models, because I want to say something about assortative mating and so on, where you need genetic models. I mean, I think the short answer is, for a lot of different genetic architecture, that still works. But, for example, I mean, I would say how well it works and how well, you know, how easy it is to evolve assortative mating and that kind of thing depends on the genetic architecture. And I don't... Yeah. I mean, I was going to say I'm not sure whether there is any general trend saying, okay, it works better with this kind of genetic architecture. Because there have been arguments made in various directions. But I would say it generally works better if you have more loci. I think that's probably, you know, kind of as a core statement, that's probably true. What's that? Right. Yeah. Right. Well, so I mean, I just, you know, maybe, I don't know, kind of insider information, but this, so, you know, this goes back and forth, and people have said, well, this is just, this doesn't happen in if you choose the model right. For example, if you use what they call the, what is it called? Well, some people call it the infinite anneals model, where you simply, in some sense, you don't have genetics, but what you assume is you have mating, and then offspring are produced, are just drawn from a distribution centered around the mid-parent value. So you don't have loci in that sense, but you have some kind of what they usually call a segregation kernel. So you have, yeah, so that's how you model mating. Once you have chosen two, the father and the mother, you say the offspring comes from a distribution that is centered around the mid-parent value. And that's, you know, you can derive such a model as a limit if you assume infinitely many loci of very small effect in linkage equilibrium, or whatever that means. So if you do that, people have said if you do that, then this doesn't happen. But that's actually not true.
But in finite loci, of course, it's a totally different state. It's classical.
Yeah, so in classical... Yeah, I mean, that's another question, yeah, which ones... I mean, on the other hand, there are just two papers last year came out that if you have multiple loci, I mean, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but if you would have multiple loci in such a model and you allow the effects of each loci to evolve, then most of the variation will be concentrated on very few loci. No, I'm not going to come. But so that would kind of show. But I can mention it again when I come to the genetics models.
Another question related to that: why do you call it organism-based model? Why is it important for you to tell it there's an organism rather than a population? Because you can stay with all these parameters into the you get to death minus the
yeah. Nothing. It's easier to explain. Well, okay. Here is the population level model. I mean, so you have this stochastic process, and there is a way of first formulating a master equation for this process, and then making certain assumptions, deriving essentially the dynamics of the mean population trait value. And what it comes down to, and this is a framework that has been developed by Hans Metz at the University of Leiden and his students and collaborators in the last 10 years or so, called adaptive dynamics. And it's essentially an extension of game theory to situations where you include population dynamics into your evolutionary dynamics. But that's probably a very cryptic statement. And I don't really want to get into this whole theory, but what it comes down to is the following. What you need to derive the evolutionary dynamics of such a trait is what is called the invasion fitness of a mutant Y in a resident that consists of only X individuals. So assume, this is kind of the scenario that I was referring to, assume before everybody has one particular trait, so a population is monomorphic for some trait value X, doesn't have to be the one in the middle, just some trait value, and then you essentially have a function that says, tells you the growth rate of rare mutants Y in this X population. So once you can derive that, I mean, that is, you know, model dependent, depending on how you set up the model, you can formulate this, and then the adaptive dynamics are simply given by the selection gradient. So you take the derivative of this function with respect to the mutant value and evaluate it at the resident. And that tells you whether, you know, it's when you increase, mutants that have a higher trait value have a higher fitness than the resident or a lower fitness. So that slope tells you what the selection gradient is. And then the trait dynamics is simply given by this selection gradient times some constant that describes the mutational process. I mean, that's very similar to quantitative genetics, except that in this function, for example, this function here incorporates the population dynamics of the resident. So the equilibrium density in the case that I'm talking about, but it could also be non-equilibrium population dynamics. Then it becomes much harder to calculate this. For example, in the predator-prey model, it could be a cyclic population dynamics, and then you would have to take averages of growth rates of mutants at different resident densities and so on. But in principle, this function incorporates population dynamics. But let's assume you can do that, and then you have a one-dimensional trait space, you just have a very simple dynamical system. It's just, you know, a 1D differential, autonomous differential equation. And of course, so if dx is bigger than zero, you know, you have selection for larger x, so x increases, and so on. So what you're looking for are equilibrium of these dynamics. So trait value is x star, such that dx star is zero. And then you can ask about the dynamical stability of such equilibria, which is simply whether, you know, the x actually converges to this x star. But you can also ask whether such equilibria are evolutionarily stable, not just dynamically stable. And so I don't want to go too much into this, but these two conditions, I mean, D is the partial derivative of F with respect to Y, evaluated at X. So this is related to F, but it's not the same. That means you can easily have this smaller than zero and this bigger than zero. And that's exactly the situation that I described before. So you have a situation where this is small. So you have an X star that is dynamically stable, so you converge to that point, but it's actually a fitness minimum. And that's an evolutionary branching point. And because these two conditions are different in general. I mean, there are models where they're not, where whenever this is smaller than zero, this has to be smaller than zero because of the model, and then you can't get evolutionary branching points. But in general, it's possible to have this smaller than zero, so the equilibrium is attracting, and this bigger than zero, so it's an evolutionary minimum, and mutants on either side can invade. And for example, these evolutionary branching points are stable fitness minima. Stable in the dynamical sense and fitness minima, I mean, and minima in the evolutionary sense, or in the, you know, in terms of this invasion fitness function. Well, I should say, at the equilibrium, necessarily the first derivative of this function is zero, because that's what D is, capital D, is the first derivative with respect to the mutant at the equilibrium, and that's zero, so it's either a fitness minimum or a fitness maximum. So if you set up that model that I just described in terms of the stochastic process using just very standard Lotka-Volterra dynamics for the density dependence, and you incorporate the resource abundance into the carrying capacity in the Lotka-Volterra model, and I didn't want to go too much into the technical details, but anyway, it's very easy, believe me, to incorporate this green and this red function into a standard Lotka-Volterra model. And that allows you to calculate this invasion fitness function. And from there, you just go through the motions, and what you see is exactly, first of all, what you see is in this case, this is always true, which is what I said before. As long as these two functions are, you know, smooth and have zero derivative at this optimal trait value, this optimal trait value is always in equilibrium, and it's always stable. And what you will see is that essentially the curvatures of these two functions determines whether it's a branching point or a fitness maximum. So in other words, I mean, just to answer your question, it's quite possible and actually, of course, in some sense preferable, because then you have analytical results to do this on a population level and in a deterministic model. And so this is kind of the end of the first part. The point is simply that evolutionary branching, this convergence to fitness minima, is a generic process. And it's not something magical. It's not something that you have to pull out of a hat. When you have frequency dependence, this is something that occurs generically and generically. By generic, I actually mean it in a mathematical sense. It occurs for an open set in parameter space. I mean, there are models where it doesn't occur for some reason. But essentially Hans Metz produced the first models of evolutionary branching in, you know, maybe 10 years ago, maybe a little later. And this, actually, I should update this. I mean, now we have lots of models describing this. There's mutualism, predation, cooperation, all kinds of models that where this phenomenon occurs. Most of these models are asexual models, but still, in terms of the ecological conditions favoring a population split, it's clear that this is, if you consider frequency dependence, which is, of course, you know, maybe mostly not done, for example, in population genetics, but if you do consider that, then conditions for lineage, adaptive conditions for lineage splitting are not a miracle at all. So selection for lineage splitting may often be just a consequence of these ecological interactions. Okay, so now I want to say a few things there. No, they don't. They're different mechanisms. There are many different mechanisms. That's why I said, you know, it could be predation, it could be so we have shown evolutionary branching in the model for cooperative investments, and it could be mutualism, how much help you give another species. So yeah, so
how universal are these curves that you show there? Are they sort of like common characteristics at some level of several models, or are they just one example of one?
Well, I would say, yeah.
I think translate cooperation as some defective systems as well.
I mean, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I mean, I would say this is just one example. But what's common is that you need this frequency dependence, which means some kind of rarity advantage for some reason. So yeah, I'm not sure in what sense you would always come back to this particular model, but I mean, what's common with this model is that there is a rarity advantage. So you don't want to be the most common type. But why that advantage is there, I think, could have many different reasons. So let me just go through a few slides about, so to speak, the genetic aspect of of this speciation problem. And actually, I should say, man, that's one of the reasons why you use the individual-based models, because when you incorporate genetics, it becomes much harder to do the analytical stuff. So let's go back to the individual-based model and just change one thing. Now your individual trait value is not given by just a number, but it's given by your genotype. So it can vary between 0 and, in this case, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. Between 0 and 16, or maybe you want to divide that by normalize it to 1 or something. So your trait value is simply, so you have a number of diploid loci, at each position you either have 0 or 1, and your trait value is simply the number of 1 alleles. or the number of red alleles in this case. So instead of just having a number, this is how you describe a phenotype. And now, and the other, the death rates are exactly the same as before. So you, if you have a trait or a number of one alleles that is rare, you have a lower death rate, everything else being equal, than if you have a common trait. So that's the same as before. Birth rates are all the same as before, but now if an individual gives birth, it chooses a mate from the population. Let's say those are hermaphroditic organisms. So now you choose a mate from that population, and then you just create an offspring according to, say, free recombination and segregation, just Mendelian genetics. That's right. I mean, in the model you have some, then you have some small mutation rate that changes the values from 0 to 1 or from 1 to 0. Yeah, so I mean, in these models, your trait values are just have 16 different values. I mean.
So my question is like, so I think from the level of the individual loci, then most of them at least want the possibility that I have either red or white.
Right.
Because otherwise, it would have
gone. Yeah. Well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. So they, I mean, there's nothing that explicitly maintains the polymorphism at every position, at every locus. But of course, if you have frequency dependence, that is a force that maintains polymorphism. Because actually frequency dependence in this model tends to favor allele frequencies of 1/2 at each locus in the random mating population, so that you have the biggest variance, so to speak, in the population. But I mean, there's no explicit mechanism saying, okay, the locus needs to be at a certain frequency, because this is an individual-based model. So anything, in principle, anything could happen. It could become monomorphic. We do incorporate these mutations. So when you produce the offspring, you just do this random segregation and recombination thing, and then you have an offspring genome, and then the loci convert, all alleles convert to the other allele with some small probability. So there is something that creates variation, even if there's no variation at the beginning. That's what it turns out. That what turns out to be the case. So it actually depends on. Right. I mean, it depends on whether, in which case you are, whether you're in the branching case or in the fitness maximum case. If the overall selection is stabilizing, then you would expect, you know, the population to become monomorphic, or at least, or minimally polymorphic, so that all of them can sit at the minimum, at the fitness maximum. So where, how polymorphic the population is essentially depends on the fitness regime or on the parameters in the model. So if you do this, and if you assume that mates are chosen at random, then you don't see any branching in the population. Now that's what I said at the beginning. So then, because you always create these intermediate types, you can't establish these different molds in the population. So now you can assume, and that's almost all I'm going to say about it, but let's just look at the very simplest scenario where you have assortative mating with respect to that trait that is on the disruptive selection. So let's say, you know, mates are chosen based on similarity in body size. So I prefer mates that look like me in terms of body size. Then, so let's see. Yeah, that's what I just said, I guess. And then you can see the branching in sexual populations. If that assortment is strong enough, that's a very, unsurprising result, because if you are extremely assorted, if that's almost like being asexual, except you still produce some kind of offspring distribution, but if you choose only the type that you are, that's almost like asexual reproduction. There we already know that we get the splitting, yes? Well, so there are, of course, a number of papers arguing this point, and that this, it depends. I mean, if that's all that's in the model, then you still need some kind of spatial arrangement, because that just leads to a runaway process in one direction. So you would need to have a situation where that process leads to a runaway process in one direction, in one area, and in another direction, in another area.
But you just mentioned that in the same area, suddenly there are two kinds of sessions, the right and simultaneously. One is saying for blue feathers, another for red feathers, and then blue feather birds preserve blue feather suckers, and red feather birds preserve red feather suckers.
Yeah, the problem is, the problem there, there are a number of problems. One of them is the suddenly arising. The other is, if you have, essentially the Gaussian exclusion principle. So if you have equivalent species that are ecologically equivalent, one of them will go extinct. So you have nothing that actually maintains the coexistence. But you can... I mean, there are also models that kind of, which are in some sense similar, that model the mates as a resource in some sense. So then you could have a similar thing going on just in the females, for example. If males are a resource, and females prefer, let's say male, I don't think it matters whether it's males or females, but let's say one of the sexes is the choosy one and the other one has this variation in some character that is chosen. And let's say this other sex, the chosen one, is fixed. And it has this, like the seed size abundance, it has or the mates of a certain type are the most common ones. Then all the females start to prefer this one, but then because all of them prefer this one, it might actually be over-exploitation, so it might actually pay to prefer a different one on either side because nobody wants those, and so you could have a similar process. So this is kind of intuitively clear, but that's a whole can of worms, of course, this whole assortative mating business, because the first question is if you make the conservative assumption that mating is random, then you can ask, why should assortment evolve? The first answer to this is kind of clear, because it's a mechanism that allows you, so to speak, to realize the adaptive potential for splitting, as we see here. But then, and that's also, I'm not sure why I did that, but that's also classic problems. Let's assume you have assortative mating based on some other trait, color or something. Then to get the split, you need a linkage disequilibrium between color and size, so that all red ones are large and all blue ones are small or something like that. And then of course recombination is a very strong process hindering that establishment of that linkage disequilibrium. So then, but I don't want to go into that, but I'm just saying like a simple perspective on this is, okay, you have this problem posed by ecology. You want to split. Then, you know, evolution finds some solution to that problem. That's like the traditional evolutionary theory is optimization. You have, you know, optimal age at maturity that you calculate somehow. The underlying assumption is evolution finds a solution to that optimization problem. And you know, that's usually not questioned. Of course, there might be constraints and so on, but in principle, you would say, well, there's evolution just finds a solution to that problem. And in some sense, you could say the same thing here. You have selection for lineage splitting. If it's not possible now, evolution finds some sort of problem to this solution to this problem and evolves some sort of assortative mating mechanism. But that's, you know, a very simplified view of things that is not always appreciated, but that's at least one starting perspective that one could take. And that's all I'm going to say regarding this whole genetic realm, unless somebody wants to talk about it more. But before I go to the experiments, I want to quickly kind of close the circle and come back to this whole geographical business and look at this evolutionary branching in spatial arenas. So let's extend the model. So now it's a little, yeah, it gets a little more complicated. And again, that's a reason why we use stochastic models, because that's also quite hard, even although not impossible, to do analytically. So now we have a spatial arena, and actually we have a gradient in this optimal phenotype in this direction. This direction doesn't really matter, but it's there because most things are two-dimensional anyway. So at any x location, we have exactly the same situation as I described before for the original stochastic process with the green and the red curve. But as the x direction varies, the position of the maximum of the green curve of this resource abundance optimum changes. So over here, the maximum is at quite a small location, so for quite a small body size is the optimal one. Over here, it's quite a large body size is the optimal one. So that's what we assume. And let's see. Okay, here is a kind of a schematic reconstruction of one of the simulations. We start off, so this is the gradient in the x direction. This is the phenotype. So there's also a direction that goes into the blackboard, but it doesn't really matter. That's the other spatial direction. So here's the body size. This is a starting configuration. It's all green. That means these guys are optimally adapted in the middle. They are not very well adapted on the sides, but that's just the starting, the initial condition. This is the spatial distribution of these green guys. And what we'll see, and so this is actually a sexual population which has another trait that evolves, which is the degree of assortment. And that trait is shown here. Intermediate trait values in this case are random mating. Trait values down here would be disassortative mating. So you like somebody who looks dissimilar to you. And in this direction, it's assortment. So you like people who look like you. And what we will see is that initially you stay in this kind of realm of almost random mating, or this region of almost random mating. And in this region, so this is going to be time here. In this region, in this time window, the population mates randomly and will just show a phenotypic gradient along this spatial gradient. And then as assortative mating increases, speciation will happen. So let's see whether... Okay, so this is the population evolving, and we just see this kind of phenotypic gradient following this environmental gradient in the optimal... I'm not sure what happened here. Let's see. Anyway, that's the end state. Getting ahead of myself again. I don't know. Let's see here. I think it's hanging, unfortunately. This is, you can think about this anyway in the meantime. That's kind of the next step is, so this is the situation as I just described, where you have a linear gradient. And then the other thing is the next step. Yeah, you know, these older power books are just not that power. Because these are a lot of the superimposed PDFs. So that's, I don't know. Okay, let's see whether we can get this going. Okay, so as I said, as long as the mating is in the region where it's not very assorted, if you see this phenotypic gradient, and then you see as this, there is selection, you know, which is emergent, so to speak, for assortative mating, then as assortative mating goes up, you see the formation of those two species. And the point here is, there's one point that I'm not showing, and that is it happens even when this sigma k is smaller than sigma alpha, so it happens on the more general conditions than in the non-spatial model. But the main point here is what you see is that there is a spatial segregation. So most of the blue ones are over here, most of the yellow ones are over here, and that means that even if you see spatially segregated species, which, you know, traditionally are associated with allopatric speciation, that doesn't necessarily mean that the driving force behind this pattern was allopatric speciation. Because in this case, it was actually the interaction happening at this interface here that drives the species apart. So, anyway, that's the next, just to drive that point home in terms of the spatial arrangement, this is what we just looked at, but you can look at other landscapes of this optimal phenotype. Let's look at this one where, you know, for most of the area, very small types are the optimal ones, but then for some small area, very big ones are the optimal ones, and so on. So here it's just one example. This is, again, the starting condition. This is what happens, and what you see is that this green one and the yellow one and the blue one are sister species. But the zone of contact between green and blue is very minimal. For example, if this were a real system and you would take a transect along this curve or along this line, you would think that, you know, these guys are allopatric, truly allopatric. They don't even have a contact zone, the green ones and the blue ones along this curve. But they are sister species. So, I mean, that's just a cautionary note to infer process from existing patterns of abundance of species. Okay, so this is the theoretical part. Evolutionary branching is a generic outcome of frequency-dependent interactions. And what I didn't really show you is that these conditions are actually less stringent for splitting in the spatial models. And it's difficult to infer process from pattern, which is, of course, an old story. But it's also true for this allopatric versus sympatric thing. So anyway, now I want to talk about these experiments that we did to, I was just wondering whether we can reproduce at least some aspect of this branching thing in experiments. We chose E. coli because you don't have to worry, normally you would say, well, you can't use bacteria to study speciation because they don't mate. Or if they do mate, it's hard to understand what they actually do. But we actually said, well, that's a good thing because that allows us to disentangle the mating stuff from the ecological stuff and just study actually the ecological conditions for diversification. Because we work with Rich Lenski's E. coli B strain, which is supposedly and hopefully, and we don't know anything else, clonal. So they don't do the conjugation business, which is why Lenski chose them. And we thought, okay, this is a system where we can study the ecology of adaptive diversification. So here's what we did. Ideally we wanted to recreate this resource, this green resource abundance. But bacteria, they have a lot of advantages, but they have some very serious disadvantages. And one of them is it's very hard to phenotype them. It's not like beak size. There's some phenotypes that are easy, but we don't know what they mean, and I'll come to that. And because it's hard to phenotype them, it's also hard to assign. It was impossible for us to find some kind of gradient that would mimic this resource abundance. So what we said, we didn't care about phenotype, we just said, okay, let's give them a mixture of two different resources that we know they use in principle, glucose and acetate. Yeah, so we haven't done that, but we want to do that. The problem with all of this is that the PI doesn't know anything about biology. So, or at least not. Well, he's learning. But anyway, when you say sequencing in terms of finding such a resource gradient or something? Or? Yeah, but still, I know. No, for sure, yeah, but I think it's still hard to find, to create this selection regime. Because you would need, first of all, find a quantitative character in these E. coli, and then find the quantitative character that actually, corresponds to, to different resource abundances and so on. It's just not clear how to recreate that situation with the green and the red curve in the lab. So instead of having a resource distribution, a continuous one, we just gave them two resources. That's all I'm trying to say at this point. I'll talk about the genetic part or some genetic aspects a little later. Anyway, so that's what we did. But these resources are, of course, they're well mixed. It's not like glucose is over here and acetate is over here. They're all of this is in well mixed populations. They're all, when they evolve, they're always shaken. And here's how they evolve. So, you just, So we have the green stuff is this resource mixture. You inoculate that, you let it sit for one day. They grow up to stationary phase, so they use up all the resources. You take a small inoculate, transfer it to new resources, to new medium, and so on for, you know, half a year. Dilution that we used here is 1 in 100, which means that they have about 6.7 generations in each of those phases. Because they always go from, you know, they multiply by 100, population density. So if you do that half a year, that's about, you know, something like on the order of 1,000 generations. Okay, here is the main preliminary finding, so to speak. This is one way of phenotyping then. You look at colony size. So this is not the medium, when you on these plates, it's not the medium that they evolve in. This is a rich medium where they have everything they want. You dilute, you take your population, you dilute it so that you only to a dilution factor so that when you pour it out on a plate, you see actually single colonies, which all come from single individuals. And then you let them grow. And then they form these colonies. And that's the ancestor. That's what you see when you do that with the ancestor. And this is what you see when you do that after 1,000 generations. So what you see is that there are two types in terms of this colony size on rich medium. It's just a phenotypic assay at this point. Some colonies are very small, or some individuals, some types form very small colonies, some form very big colonies, and this is a heritable trait. So if you take these ones, plate them again, they make big colonies. Take these ones, plate them again, they make small colonies. Because yeah, I mean, this, as I said, this is just a phenotypic assay.
Yeah, but I guess the implication from this experiment is that you start growing those E. coli on the nature of food, and then you get a species to that. One of them would be better than for testing, and that will help for the implementation. But wouldn't you in nature test them on homogeneous sources of food? You started.
Yeah. The problem is that then you, if you did this, when we did this, if you do this on the evolution medium, the colony size do not vary very much. So it's just not a good phenotypic assay. Yeah, but I mean, you know, it doesn't matter. In principle, it doesn't matter which phenotypic assay you choose. I mean, this shows that there are two different types. Of course, it doesn't say what they do and what they are, but it shows that there are two different types. So this was, you know, this was very exciting for us when we first saw that, because it means that something happened, even though we didn't know what happened. So. Yeah, okay, so actually I should mention that from now on. The S type is for small and the L type is for large. Yeah.
So when you start this original experiment, you have just 1 month. So what will happen now is if you start the experiment?
Well, you know, so I'll come to that at the very end, but I mean, that's a good question. And we actually, let's see, we did that, but we don't know yet what happened. I mean, the thing is, you can do a lot of things with these things, and that's, and so we haven't done all these things because it's all quite labor intensive. But that's a good question, you know. If, for example, in the models, if you, say in the stochastic models, if you just by force one branch to go extinct, then you just go back to the branching point and branch again in the model. so you could test whether that's actually the case. And actually, yeah, so we did that, but we don't know yet what's happening. Okay, so here is our hypothesis. What's going on? What these guys do when they grow in a glucose acetate mixture is they first use glucose and then they use acetate. It's called the dioxic switch because they prefer glucose. Then they eat up all the glucose and then they eat whatever is left. So what they have is they have an exponential growth on the first resource, then they have a lag phase where they try and kind of reprogram their metabolism, then they have a second exponential growth, and then they go into stationary phase. And essentially what, you know, it's kind of once you see that pattern, it's pretty close to hypothesizing that this pattern is different for the two types. So could be that, you know, one type has a higher growth rate in the first phase, but then a long switching lag and a lower growth rate in the second phase because of some trade-off, and vice versa in the other type. So that was our working hypothesis. And it came also from actually measuring growth profiles. So this is the ancestor is actually, you can't see it, but the ancestor looks in shape like these L colonies. These are the L colonies, the large ones. So they have a distinct switching lag. It takes them quite a long time to get into this second growth phase, whereas the L colonies have a very short switching lag. So they do have different growth profiles. And you can then measure various, you know, those are again just phenotypic assays, for example. Even though they evolve on glucose and acetate, you can just measure them in glucose alone, growth rate, where they just have one exponential phase. You can measure them in acetate, and you can measure switching lags. And when you do this analysis, you can make this distinction. So they're all, in terms of these assays, these types are different. So that gives us some clue about the ecology of what they are actually doing. So then we wanted to know how they do this. What's different in their metabolism? And of course, metabolism is a complicated thing in E. coli already. I mean, it's actually extremely complicated because there are just very many connections between different parts of pathways. But because this, so we try to connect. Let's try to understand the physiological basis of this ecological difference. And we concentrated on the central central carbon metabolism because those are carbon resources. And so we have essentially glycolysis and the Krebs cycle. And we looked at, this is the pathway that we are focusing on. So what happens when they grow? So we have two types. When they grow in glucose, they go through this. They gobble up glucose and go through glycolysis, and they essentially generate byproducts of glycolysis. To get more glucose, take in more glucose and produce more energy, they have to get rid of these byproducts. So this station here has to be cleared. And there are essentially different ways of doing that. You can just excrete these byproducts, just get rid of them, excrete them into the medium, or you can use them to go through the TCA cycle and what is called the glyoxylate shunt. And this, so I should say, so this is the type that does this. We call the fermenter. This guy, the excretion of these byproducts is a fast process. So they can take up glucose faster because they can get rid of the byproducts faster, but they lose all whatever energy, or essentially whatever energy is contained in the byproducts. They just lose that because they throw it away. Or they could be respirers where they go through a slower process, but they use the energy that, or at least part of the energy that is in these byproducts. So that would be the respirer. And these guys could even actually take up some of the acetate, even while they're growing on glucose. They could use some of the acetate. What they usually do, and that's what the ancestor does, is as long as they grow on glucose, they repress these pathways. That's what the wild type does. At least the wild type that we have. It just tries to gobble up glucose as fast as it can and gets rid of the byproducts. So this is the strong repressor, the fermenter, the strong repressor of these pathways, if these secondary pathways. And so what we think is going on, or one possibility that could be going on, that the other type, the one, well, the coexisting type, is a weak repressor of the secondary pathways. And there could be, you know, I mean, so then for coexistence, there needs to be a trade-off between the two. And one reason why there could be a trade-off is because these guys are, so to speak, ready to use the acetate once the glucose is gone, because they are using, they're already, while they're growing on glucose, they are using, at least partly, they are using this acetate pathway. So once the glucose is gone, they can just keep going, essentially. Whereas these guys, they have to reprogram and activate this cycle here. So that, therefore, there could be a trade-off. So this could be bad during growth on glucose, but good once the glucose is gone. So here is some indication that this is what's going on. Here is glucose and acetate concentrations as they grow in this first phase. So glucose goes down from here to here, and acetate goes up because that's the byproduct of this glycolysis. So this is what the ancestor does. It starts out here, then glucose goes down to zero, it uses up the glucose, and acetate, the acetate concentration actually increases in the medium. This is also what the L-type does, the one, the guy that forms the large colonies, but the small, the S-type does a different thing. It uses up glucose, but acetate doesn't go up, and that means it somehow uses acetate, even while it is growing on glucose. So, and as I said, so this is an indication that these are actually, that this is what's going on. And a trade-off is actually not enough for coexistence. As I was trying to argue before, what we need is is frequency dependence, which means it's good to be the rare type. So if everyone is good on glucose, then it's good to be the respirer. If everyone is a fermenter, it's good to be a respirer. If everyone is a respirer, it's good to be the fermenter, and so you can do invasion experiments where you start off, say, with a lot of large types and very few small types, and then you go to some intermediate frequency, which means the small types can increase when rare. But the opposite is also true. If you start off with very few large types and a lot of small types, the large type can increase in frequency and you reach some intermediate frequency. So in all these populations, so of course we had this, I forgot to say this, but you know, you do replicate lines of these evolution experiments. So these are, we have different populations, and there are, so all these analyses take time and money, so you can't analyze all the replicates, so we just choose the ones that look the nicest. But anyway, these, so you can see this frequency dependence. The rare type can invade, so to speak. What's that? Exactly. This is exactly like a classical Hochdorf game. Okay, so then we try to understand what's going on in the genetics, and maybe that's a little bit has to do with molecular networks now. So we try to analyze, you know, well, what's going on in terms of the metabolic, or the genes, with gene expression, what's going on with expression of the genes that activate these metabolic pathways, and what are the actual genetic changes that might be responsible for the difference between the strains. So there are, you know, because of this, well, because we are looking at this, at these carbon pathways, there are some candidate genes that we looked at. For example, we sequenced the ACS gene and didn't find anything, including the promoter region. Didn't find any differences, at least in this population that we chose to look at for this particular study. But then we looked at genes that are involved in this glyoxylate shunt, which is activated when you use acetate. And what you would expect is that you would expect that a type that eats acetate while growing on glucose has these genes more expressed than a type that doesn't eat acetate. So this is the expectation when growing on glucose. So we looked at this particular gene, ASB, which is part of this back operon, is expressed more in the small ones, in the respirer, when they grow on glucose than in the large ones. And that's exactly what we found. This is when they grow on acetate. All three of them have a high expression of this gene because they use it. This is used when you grow on acetate. When you grow in a mixture of glucose and acetate in the glucose phase, so in the first phase of the dioxic pattern, or when you grow just on glucose, in both cases, the smalls have a much higher expression of this ASB gene than either the large or the ancestor. So somehow that pathway, this means that pathway is activated even when these guys are growing on glucose. But of course, that's just gene expression, so that doesn't mean that, you know, that doesn't really tell you where the genetic change is. So we looked for various things. So we sequenced the regulatory sequence, and then we looked at other regulatory genes. So I guess this would be a trans gene. Finally, I mean, to make a long story short, and it was a long story, what we found is that these guys, so there's this ICLR gene, which is a suppressor of this pathway. And it is known that this ICLR is expressed in the wild type when they grow on glucose. And what we found in one population, that the smalls had an insertion in this ICLR gene, which essentially was a knockout. And so this suppression didn't function anymore, and therefore ASB was overexpressed. So that's the genetic change that we found. Interestingly, in other populations we didn't see that. So that means somehow there must be different ways of activating or deactivating this pathway. But this is one change that we found. Then another thing that we now you have this inserted ICLR gene, and you wonder, okay, you can put that thing back into the ancestor, or you can put the ancestral gene into the derived strain and see to detect how big the effect of that insertion is. If you put the ancestral strain, so this is the dark blue is just the smalls as they have evolved with this ICLR insertion, so with the overexpression of ASB. These are the smalls transformed with the ancestral ICLR. And what we see here is a significant effect that the switching lag becomes bigger. So it seems that in the smalls, this ICLR insertion really does have an effect. However, in the ancestor, it doesn't seem to have an effect. So if we put the ICLR inserted ICLR gene into the ancestor, we don't see a difference. That means probably that there are epistatic effects. So this ICLR insertion only has an effect in the genetic background of the small, but not in the genetic background of the ancestor. We don't know why that is. But it probably means that there are other genetic changes between the ancestor and the derived strain. And in fact, so in the meantime, we have done global expression analysis using microarrays, and in terms of expression, there are hundreds of differences between smalls and larges. And we have about 5 candidate genes that we are now sequencing and doing real-time PCR on that we think are all different between these strains. So now I want to just quickly come back to this evolutionary branching thing and why I think this diversification is an example of evolutionary branching, or some of the reasons why I think it is an example of evolutionary branching. So there was a paper in Science in, I think, 2004 or 2005 by Buckling and colleagues. And they essentially made the point that the tendency to, so they have this, I don't know whether you have seen this, but they have this Pseudomonas system. I think this is a Pseudomonas word, which is essentially made famous by Trevisano and Rainey, where they have this radiation in a spatial microcosm with the wrinkly spreaders and the smooth ones and the fuzzy ones. And what these guys did is they kind of proved classical theory. So classical theory of diversification is with static fitness landscapes. So not frequency dependent. So fitness landscapes are constant over time. But according to that picture, and this is actually a figure from an editorial piece in Science on that Science paper, that's the classical picture. As long as you are not on the fitness peaks of the static fitness landscape, you can diversify, but then as you climb these peaks, the tendency to diversify decreases. Because the distance to alternative peaks increases. So at the beginning, it's more likely to diversify. And then as local adaptation happens, the tendency to diversification decreases. And that's what they showed. And this is exactly the opposite of what you would expect with evolutionary branching, because with evolutionary branching, you first need to evolve to your fitness minimum, and then diversification happens. So under that scenario, the tendency to diversification actually increases over time. So, and this is, you know, I said you can do many things, and this is one of the things we did. So here is this one of the populations that we looked at, and so, you know, one of the big advantages or one of the advantages of bacteria is you have a fossil record. You just freeze down the samples at regular time intervals, so you can go back and kind of, and you see in terms of, for example, the acetate lag, so the time it takes them to switch to the second resource, you can see this kind of branching pattern, or at least you can see the diversification. So now you can ask yourself, let's see whether the likelihood of diversification increases over time. So you can take individual strains, individuals from this time point, or from this time point, which are all time points where there is no diversification, or very little. But in any case, you start new evolution experiments from single strains. So the new evolution experiments are started from monomorphic populations that all have a large switching lag. Now, what you would maybe the null hypothesis would be during this time, it just kind of rains mutations, and if you get the right one, you diversify. If that's true, you would expect that the propensity for diversity is the same in all three time points, because you're just waiting for the right mutation or mutations. But it doesn't matter. All the other stuff doesn't matter. You're just waiting for the right thing to happen. But then you would expect that all the, as I said, then you would expect that the amount of diversity in this in such re-diversification experiments would be the same for all three time points. But that's not what we see. So what we do is we take individuals from this time, from the ancestor, from this time point and from this time point, single individuals, replicated, evolved them for 140 generations, and then we test how many of those populations are actually dimorphic. And what we see is that these C populations, even though they are started from single individuals, have a much higher likelihood of becoming dimorphic after 140 generations than A and B. And so that means the propensity to diversification increases over evolutionary time, which is exactly what you would expect if it has something to do with this, approaching the right ecological conditions before you can diversify.
Is that such a statement that you need more than one mutation? And maybe the B and C friends already have some of the...
That's right. So you need more than one mutation. But, that's actually a good point. I mean, the alternative explanation, obviously you need more than one mutation, but the question is why? Do you need more than one mutation because first you need to, so to speak, create the right ecological conditions before you can get coexistence? Or do you need more than one mutation before you can actually produce this new type? Because it just needs more than one mutation. So is it genetic or is it ecological?
Yeah.
The point, so one of the things here is that you actually see that other type even from the ancestor. So even starting from here, it's not that there is no diversification. So in some sense, genetically, it's possible to get that type.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you would have...
Right. Yeah, so that's true. I mean, it's not clear that whether it's just genetic or ecological constraints. And it's actually a good point, because one thing we haven't done yet is to take these diversified strains and compete them against the ancestor. So what we would expect is, that's a good point. What we would expect is that then, because if the ecological hypothesis is right, then you would expect that it can't survive in the ancestor. So if you short circuit the genetic problem of having, of needing multiple mutations by just putting it in yourself, you could test whether it's ecological or genetic. So that's a good point, actually. Nevertheless, as I said, so the small type, or at least a type with a short acetate lag, actually does appear in the ancestor sometimes. But just not as often as in the ones that are started from C. Anyway, so we, at least at some level, at least the pattern is opposite to what is described in this other paper, where the likelihood of diversification decreases over time. So, that's about it. I mean, the conclusions from... So we are still doing a lot of work with these... it's kind of hard going, but as I said, we did these expression studies and we are sequencing some of these genes. But what is, what seems clear to us is that frequency dependence does play a role in this diversification. Because of, well, you can show frequency dependence operating between the small and the largest. And what I like about this system is that with essentially you can integrate mechanisms on many different biological levels with these bacteria. So the genetic level, the physiological level, the ecological level, and the long time span level, so the evolutionary level. So I think these they may actually be the only system where you can directly study the process of diversification. Okay, so well, I guess it took about twice as long as I should have, but now it's essentially over. So the point, the main point in terms of the theory was that this adaptive lineage splitting is a generic process, at least in the model. So in some sense, sympatric speciation is a plausible evolutionary process. And I think what has been partly overlooked for a long time in sympatric speciation models is that ecology is as important as population genetics for the process of speciation. Because for a very long time, the model for sympatric speciation were these Levine patch models where people knew that to get disruptive selection, fitness minima, you have to make very special assumptions. And that's one of the reasons why people think sympatric speciation is not a plausible process, because they always thought, you know, if you need to make special assumptions, use special models, it's not going to be a general process. But this theory of adaptive dynamics shows that you don't need special assumptions. You need frequency dependence. But that's a point I wanted to make before. I mean, frequency dependence, when as a response maybe to your question about whether everything can be, you know, brought back to this red and the green curve. I mean, to me, frequency dependence versus non-frequency dependence is a little bit like adaptive evolution versus neutrality. If you measure in a biological sense, non-frequency dependence is a set of measure zero in all of the model space, because it means that something is equal to zero, whereas frequency dependence means that something is not equal to zero. So that's a much larger set. So in general, frequency dependence, I think, is the rule. But non-frequency dependence is the exception. Of course, a little bit of frequency dependence might still be non-frequency dependence, just like a little bit of non-neutrality is still neutral because of population size. So there is a little margin around that. But just as a logical principle, I think, you know, I mean, as I said, it's like neutral evolution. I think if you can measure, you know, precisely enough, there is no neutral no neutral mutation. It's just that there are maybe many mutations that have very small effects and therefore are effectively mutant. But in the same sense, there is no non-frequency dependent selection. It always depends. What is good for you, in some sense, always depends on what everybody else is doing. So then these points I tried to make about the spatially structured populations, just to kind of close the circle and come back to this whole allopatric story. And the point there is that, you know, you have to distinguish between pattern and process, and then finally, these evolutionary experiments which allow us to tackle these processes experimentally. And that's it. There's a lot of people I'd like to thank. Maybe the one thing I'd like to point out is that the James S. McDonald Foundation, I don't know whether you've heard of these guys, but they were very generous in supporting me and a lot of other people. And that's what allowed me to establish the lab this experimental component, and that's pretty good for me. Thanks very much.